The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events. Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Our guest today, David, we had 2 years ago on this program. And what I loved about his perspective is he brought science into the mix. He understands the logarithmic progression of debt, of population, of energy usage. And, you know, it's something that we don't really perceive as human beings, but when you do 10 to the 2, 10 to the 3, 10 to the 4, those are massive, massive changes, and that's what he's looking at as far as economic change coming up.
I'm always fascinated by people who have a particular background and have a passion about something that is not necessarily in their background. I mean, I think of T.S. Eliot as a banker.
Right.
He was also a great poet. You know, and you'd say, well, how can you be both? Isn't it sort of different sides of the brain? No, actually, it's interesting. When you begin to sort of dig into the world deeply in one area, it's, you have the ability at that point to then go laterally and look at other areas with the same level of depth. And that's one of the things I appreciate about Chris Martinson. I mean, background as a scientist and yet his interest in the world of finance and economics has sort of opened up to him here in the last 10, 15 years in a self-educated way, but taking his ability again to rigorously think about an issue, the process that he would apply scientifically to go through and unpack an issue, even though it may not be in the realm of science. But it gives fresh eyes to something that can be fairly sterile. The work of an economist done by an economist is really hard to read by a non-economist. But
right.
The work of an economist done by a scientist actually is very intriguing to read because it brings new light to the old issues. And I think that's why, I continue to be fascinated by the work that Chris does.
Well, the book that Chris wrote a couple of years ago, Crash Course, is written to the layman, though. We don't want to discourage that. I mean, it's a layman's look from a scientist at economics. And so I'm looking forward to the talk today.
Well, Chris, thanks for joining us again. It is something that is really obvious, perhaps to you and I, but not so obvious to the rest of the world. Complacency is a factor in the marketplace today. We have recovery. Clearly, we have economic growth. Clearly, according to those new GDP statistics, we have had actually economic recovery for many years now. The recession wasn't quite as bad as we thought. At least the revised numbers would tell us that. Let's discuss this as a social issue. Complacency. You've described this as sort of the unwary, the careless, maybe even the reckless. And it puts us in somewhat of a vulnerable position. But maybe you can just address that notion of complacency, where and how you see it today.
Absolutely. I think that quite a number of people, investors, particularly some of the larger investors out there, have just gone along with the idea that not only do you not fight the Fed, but you can really trust the Fed. And this lesson, I think, was well learned, right? We had long-term capital management, big bailout in 1998, and then we had the rescue with ultra-low interest rates following the stock market correction in 2000-2001. Then we had the housing bubble. And then, of course, the Fed, after Bloomberg showed us the FOIA, released articles and transcripts that they got, that the Fed had engaged in 21,000 separate transactions with businesses all over the world, other central banks, just basically providing liquidity. And so there's this sense now that no matter what happens, there's the Bernanke put, or collectively the central bank put, there's not a lot of downside, and then everybody's just going to try and scoop up as much of the upside as they can. And so this complacency, I think, is well-earned in the sense that as long as all you're doing is looking at price action, there's a pretty good case to be made for might as well just follow the price action. But when you look at the macro trends underneath all of that, you look at things like not just the total level of unemployment, but how that's distributed across a society, really concentrating on the under 30 crowd in most countries where it's showing up. And you look at the level of sovereign indebtedness, you know, is that going up or is it going down? You know, obviously it's still going up. The United States, of course, has a much better comparison to make because the BLS waved its magic wands and statistically revised the entire GDP data series. So we can't even compare fruit to fruit on that one anymore, year to year. And magically we're $300 billion richer in terms of income, and we have a much stronger economy than we thought. And yet, when we look under that, what's really going on in the overall economy, we're not seeing the kinds of things that I like to equate with real, sustainable, fundamental growth that I can really believe in, which includes good capital expenditures, reinvestment in new technologies, people being hired for full-time jobs so that there's a real commitment to developing a strong workforce, and education. There's some big, big pieces missing here.
You've pointed out that bubbles require a certain set of beliefs, and you've just touched on some of those beliefs. You know, there is this notion in traders, in the world of traders and investors, that you should not fight the Fed. Is that a part of this ingrained belief system that as long as the Fed has your back, as long as the central bank community has your back, is putting wind into the sails, you just have to go along with it? A little bit like musical chairs. The music plays, and we play the game, and we assume that we're not going to be the unlucky one that is left out when the music stops. What are the kinds of beliefs do you think are sort of propelling the current bubble dynamics?
Oh, well, besides those, it has to be something along the lines of, this time is different. I think you really have to believe that this time the Fed is going to be able to control the macroeconomy, that it actually is in control, that it has the capability of translating fresh money printing from their magic, you know, computer keyboards, that that will somehow make it into the economy in the right way and do the right things. And that's not a set of beliefs I'm willing to hold. Instead, I hold a slightly different view. I look at the large sweep. I think, you know, we came from former Fed chairman way back, Arthur Burns, then we come into Volcker, two men who I believe really, really had the political independence of the Fed at the core of their operating principle. The Fed had a role and it was separate from fiscal policy, it was separate from standard politics, all of that. Then Alan Greenspan comes along. You know, we had a hiccup in 1994. That was really, I think, where I traced the beginnings of this whole scenario that we happened to be in. He had an opportunity there. We could have done a couple of things. One, faced a bubble that was existing at that point in corporate bonds. He decided to turn away from that, implemented something called the sweeps program, enabling banks to effectively fully evade any sort of reserve requirements whatsoever. And that allowed this huge explosion in the money supply, which, of course, led to the tech bubble. And so when I look at the sweep of this, I think that, you know, LTCM was kind of a little hiccup. The bubble blow up in stocks, mainly in the tech side, that was a larger crisis. Then we had this housing bubble. That was an even larger crisis than those. And we're going to have one that's even larger than those. And so in this story, what I see as I look back in history is a little error that then got compounded into a larger error that got compounded into a larger error. And now we're faced with, it really is do or die time. The Fed either gets this right or it gets it horribly, horribly wrong. That's the risk. And that's why I think complacency is not really a good, solid investing trait to be holding at this point.
You know, we have both, I think, been familiar with a little bit of science background, you with a PhD, mine with just some undergraduate classes. But I did take time to read Thomas Kuhn's The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, plenty of philosophy classes and whatnot. He focuses on the fact that communities are stuck with a set of assumptions, and that for a time, those assumptions allow them to answer questions and do good work, whether it's in science or, in this case, if you want to borrow the concept and apply it to our central bankers. Then you have issues that come along and the assumptions no longer really address everything that you're dealing with. You have problems that can't be solved given the, again, the current issues in front of you. And ultimately, there's a paradigm shift. There is a radical relook at everything that you based your science on. And we have central bankers today that play a massive role. One of the things that you've pointed out recently is that the role that, you know, an Einstein played, you know, close to 70, 80 years ago, he's sort of in the public sphere. Everyone knew who he was, and he was a bit of a scientific rock star. The rock stars of today are bankers and hedge fund managers, and we're still pretending like, yes, like you said, this time is different. We can print. We can continue to create money as if that's as good as creating real things. What made this country great a long time ago was industrial capacity, new and innovative ideas, a business cycle that, yes, had booms and busts, but allowed for there being a cleansing, if you will, and a restart. We don't have that. This time, in some respects, is different, but only because we're trying to promote a set of ideas and ideals, and it's gone viral. It's not just the Fed. Maybe that's what's different. If you go back, as you mentioned, to Arthur Burns, Arthur Burns would have stood alone as a man who was monetizing debt in the early 70s and who was running the printing presses, albeit from a politically reserved or removed place. But he was alone in that. Now you've got Abe and Mr. Caruta. You've got Mario Draghi. You've got Mark Carney. All of your world central bankers are doing the same thing. Where do you see this paradigm coming to pieces? I mean, is it perhaps Japan and sort of this notion of Abenomics as we experiment with it? Is that perhaps the final straw on the camel's back where we just say, you know what, this actually doesn't work?
Oh, such great questions and observations there. I'm of the mind, after having watched this unfold for about a decade now, I've been paying very close attention, and I'm seeing that Detroit is kind of my metaphor. I think what we do is we run it until it just completely breaks and you finally have to admit it. I'm not seeing anything that says that central banks are willing to entertain the harder question. And here's the harder question. Starting in early 80s, let's peg it at 1980 just to make it clean, what happened in the United States and across the rest of the OECD countries was we started to accumulate debt. This is total credit market debt across our entire set of institutions. This isn't just your usual debt to GDP, meaning federal debt or sovereign debt. This is all manner of debt, household, corporate, state and local, all the forms of debt you can think of. And we started to accumulate that at a rate about twice nominal GDP growth. You know, so if nominal GDP was 4 or 5%, we might be having 8 to 10% growth in total credit market debt. And we've lived since the 80s as if that's just how things are. And the whole world is sort of bought onto that, and cultures got conditioned to that, call it a sense of entitlement, what have you. But the issues that we have looming here around our pensions, around Social Security, around Medicare, all the entitlement programs are the same as the ones that they've got in Japan, same as they've got in Europe, which is there's this extraordinary mismatch between what's been promised and what can possibly reasonably be delivered, even under some really robust assumptions of a return to rapid growth. And that's kind of what I think the larger piece that's not really being admitted, not really being looked at hard. So when you mention you've got a Carney and a Draghi and an Abe and a Bernanke all sort of conspiring, if I can use that word, to just print so that we can continue this practice of getting our credit markets growing faster than underlying GDP. Now, that's what they're trying to do. Whether that's wise or not, I have an opinion. I don't think it's terribly wise because I know something. I know that I personally cannot increase my debts faster than my income forever. It has a math function. It breaks at some point. I think well before you get to that mathematical hard limit, though, it breaks for other reasons. I mean, the stresses and strains of it just show up. And sooner or later, at least one of these parties is going to say, enough. We have to begin the process of living within our means. We're going to have to begin the process of making sure that our total accumulation of credit matches our actual output. And, you know, the way you skate around that story for a little while, the way you extend and pretend on that story is you drop interest rates. Because if you were paying 4 or 5%, you can get that down to 1%. You can continue to accumulate more debt because the servicing costs are less. But even that has a run-out function. And, you know, here we are, what are we, 3 years into 0% interest rates now, and we still don't have the economic growth we'd hoped for. And the Fed, I know, has just been fingers crossed, double praying, please let that growth come back. It hasn't. And if I could get 10 magic minutes with the Fed, I would just point to them a chart of the price of oil. And I would say, here's why. Here's why you're not going to get a rapid resumption of growth. We've never had rapid growth with oil at $100 a barrel, inflation adjusted. This is a new reality. We're not getting cheap oil ever again. And what are you going to do about that? It means you have to rethink your whole paradigm. And that's what I think they're missing. They want the 80s again. They want the 90s again. They want the 2000s again. But it is kind of a new landscape. And oil, to me, is the linchpin of that story.
You know, it's interesting. You look at a long-term chart of the commodities market, say the CRB, just as an index. Maybe the CCI is a better one, but you are two times what we were at in terms of prices back 10, 12 years ago. And this is a long, I mean, we've had a major correction in industrial commodities. We're not at the peak prices we had in oil at $147. We certainly have natural gas well off its peaks from a few years ago. And yet you look at the commodities index and we're still better than twice what we had 10 years ago. And as you say, you bring those input costs into real goods and things that are delivered, services that are delivered to us, this is an issue. You are looking at a dramatic step up in cost. You mentioned nominal GDP. Nominal GDP, I happen to have a chart of that in front of me. it began to break down in 2000. And next thing you know, you've got the S&P following suit. It began to break down. This is nominal GDP. It began to move lower considerably in the year 2006 and was very much a canary in the coal mines. Okay. And it took some time, but there you had sort of levitation process, the Bernanke put in play until the inevitable could not be held back. And actually we began to see nominal GDP break down off of peaks in the first quarter of 2012. Now we've actually seen it break support here at the beginning of 2013, and no one seems to be noting the divergence between nominal GDP and the S&P. The S&P continues to motor higher, as if everything is just fine. Meanwhile, nominal GDP, it's not in free fall today, but it has broken support every time in the last 12 years that that has happened. Katie, bar the door. There was major issues, mean reversion, and what you've described as potential energy. That's what we have today in the stock market. Unfortunately, it's potential energy that could become kinetic and quite deadly if someone's not careful.
I absolutely agree, and there's really one person who does track that out of many who don't, and that's John Hussman. And he's, you know, I've seen a nice chart that he's put up where he shows that whenever nominal GDP dips below 3.7%, every time, six out of six times, we've had a recession that followed. And we're basically at that threshold again. And so you would think there would be some room for caution, there would be some room for investors to wonder how they were going to begin to maneuver in this space. And I think we got our first warning shot as to how this is going to play out. That was June 19th and 20th. Now, you know, a lot of that was Bernanke came out with some comments, and we saw everything get sold in those 2 days. Everything. Commodities, stocks, bonds, you name it. Everything got sold. And that's what we saw in 2008. That's your classic liquidity crisis, right? We know we've got a lot of leverage, a lot of margin, a lot of different sort of compounding ways that people are playing in the markets right now. And so, when you get a flushing moment, everything tends to get washed at once, and you see everything get sold. That did get reversed, but it's really important to note here that that dynamic can still exist, and that this whole market now is just keying off of what the Fed says, what it doesn't say. And that's not investing, that's speculating. So we're speculating grossly, I mean everybody in aggregate, with the markets. And the faith is that not only are the central banks going to be able to undo what they've done gracefully, but they're going to continue this long enough that somehow economic growth catches up with it. But when you wander over to that part of the story, it's not there. In fact, it looks to be going the other direction. You know, the economic growth is just not there in Southern Europe. It's not there for Europe in general. It's really not there very strongly yet for Japan. I have questions as to whether it ever will be. In the United States, let's be honest, the reason we're not in recession is the level of deficit spending by the federal government, which is emboldened and enabled by a central bank that prints money out of thin air to monetize that borrowing. And without that dynamic, we would be in a very different circumstance. So when I look at the overall macro landscape, what I see is at least enough warning signs that intelligent people should be saying, why don't we have growth? Where is it? Will it ever come back again? Is something structurally different now? And there are economists who are starting to wonder if finally, 10 years later, if something really has shifted in this story, and maybe it's something more than just demographics and debt and things like that. And so they're starting to pull these pieces in. And to me, that's what you have to do. You have to look at where we are in the energy story. We have to look at where we are with demographics. You have to see where we are with the overall debt loads. And then increasingly, we have to factor in that we're having more and more costs show up for because our weather has been a little crazy lately. And these are just, you know, maybe normal factors of life. But when you put them all in one spot and then see the stock market just powered all-time new highs, that's where my personal sense of disconnect starts to show up. And that's also where I start to get more and more concerned. Because my personal preference is I would much rather fall off the third rung of the stepladder than the eighth. It feels like we've really gotten ourselves pretty high up in a place where, if I could use this, I think the markets are priced for perfection, and I don't think they're going to find perfection.
It was interesting watching a Bloomberg interview just a few weeks ago, and they had a guest on from the Economic Cycles Research Institute, and they would hardly give him a word edgewise, just to say, here's what we think, because they already kind of knew what he was going to say, and it's that the ECRI has seen us as entering in a recession as of 2012. And again, that flies in the face of official statistics, But the ECRI has been pretty reasonable at calling recessions. And they would argue that, yes, we're already in a recession. But it was fascinating to see sort of, again, it's a bias, kind of going back to that notion of a paradigm or a mindset that just doesn't allow for anything to the contrary. And they just didn't want to have anything to do with it. There's no possible way. It was an outright rejection of what I thought were very clearly stated facts. Here's what we look at. Here are the variables. This is why we believe in recession. No countering of those facts. Mainly just a blanket statement of that's absurd. Obviously, look at jobs. And that was one of the comments made. Look at jobs. We've got this massive increase in jobs. And therefore, how could we be in recession? And of course, I mean, I think you would agree with me. U3, U6, we can scratch our heads and say that's a far cry from an accurate picture of the employment backdrop. But we do have what I think will be the shocking reality, as in when we do have mean reversion in the equity market. Everyone's going to be scratching their head and saying, but I was told we were fine. I'm very intrigued by the book that you wrote because it really does more or less lay a roadmap out for saying, no, you really do need to bring all these factors in and consider disparate data points and see how interconnected they are. We have major issues to deal with. And I think the challenge will be for many in the general public to sort of grasp, I've been lied to, or I've been deceived, or there's been a bias in the information as it was presented, and I wasn't given a very clear picture. What do people do at this point, in your opinion, to sort of take away the veil without seeming sort of radically inclined, like some, I don't know, there's so many people who have thought that there would be inflation on a grand scale and therefore gold and silver, for instance, would go up. And here we in the last 2 years don't have that. We have had people who've thought, you know, when Reagan came into power and we saw massive deficit spending, that would be unsustainable. And yet, as you mentioned, we had $5 trillion in credit market debt about 1980. We've expanded that to $55 trillion, right along with a massive expansion in GDP. Why can't we just continue this forward?
Well, the reason we can't just continue this is that it's not possible to print real purchasing power out of thin air. It's just an accounting identity. So when the Federal Reserve prints $85 billion and goes out and buys mortgage-backed security or a treasury note or something like that, let's trace out what's really happening here. The Federal Reserve created that $85 billion out of thin air, went out and bought that mortgage-backed security. Let's say that's all they bought, $85 billion in MBS paper. And that MBS paper, if we trace it all the way back, at some point there was real activity that was associated with that. At a point, a house got built and a house got sold and it got furnished. And all of these things happened that are very real. But what happened, just note what happened here. The Fed purchased that $85 billion, and it did it by just creating it out of thin air. And everybody acts as if, well, that's monetary policy. And it, in fact, you can't just print purchasing power out of thin air. Purchasing power has to come from real activities by real people. And so when the Fed does that, by definition, they're taking it from somewhere else. And this is where the story is different now. And it's different because 20 years ago, we didn't have the extraordinary concentration of wealth that we do today. And that provides a big mitigating factor to seeing a rapid rise in inflation. Because when you take, 400 of the wealthiest people in the world and they own whatever they own, 25, 30, 40% of the world's wealth, whatever it is, some silly number, then, if you make them twice as rich, because Bernanke's printed all this money up, they don't increase the world's consumption by twice, according to the formula that we'd have to use there. So we have this extraordinary concentration of wealth that allows huge pools of this money that the Fed's printing to just basically go land in already very, very large pools. And let's be really clear about something. The middle and lower classes are not participating in this. Real median wages are going backwards. We have more and more people on food stamps. This growing tension between the very, very wealthy and everybody else is an unhealthy tension in my estimation, and it explains why we don't see the explosion in inflation like we would expect. We don't have a wage spiral this time, which is the usual and necessary component for actual inflation. So there's a lot of pieces missing, but what's not missing is this idea that with the Fed printing money out of thin air, they're just adding additional stresses on an already stressed system. I know it looks helpful and it makes the markets feel better and all of that, but they're just piling up more and more claims on an economy that, if we're honest with ourselves, is not growing like it used to. And we should be really honest and maybe adult and ask ourselves, can it ever grow that way again? And if not, what would be the best course of action. And if we have a lower growth economy, we definitely need less money printing. We do not need more claims on that future economy being created out of thin air. We need fewer. And that's the conversation nobody really wants to have. So you got the Fed pump, 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 pump. Nobody really wants to look at it too closely because for now everything's okay. And then when it breaks, it'll be just like every other bubble that's ever broken. By definition, the vast majority of people will be surprised, and the vast majority of people will lose and lose badly when it bursts.
I liked your article, Bankers Own the World. It was two quotes that stood out to me. One, Josiah Stamp, Bank of England chairman from the 1920s, saying, you know, take away from them the power to create money, and all the great fortunes, like mine, will disappear. And they ought to disappear, for this would be a happier and better world to live in. But if you wish to remain the slaves of bankers and pay the cost of your own slavery, let them continue to create money. Here you were just describing central banks creating money. They are the pushers, if you will, creating fiat money. But then you also have the distributors in the system. That's Wall Street and the banks. And one of the things you pointed out in this article is that there has been a massive concentration of wealth, both financial assets as well as productive assets, amongst just a few corporations. And maybe you could expand on that, just the strange nature, that concentration of wealth amongst just a few companies in the world today. Ironically, most of them banks.
Well, it's interesting. If you go back to the era known as robber barons, and people will look back at that and generally agree or have been taught that that was not an optimal sort of a situation, you know, the robber barons. They were just rapacious industrialists who happened to just accumulate monopolistic power, and that was detrimental. So we broke them up, and that was a good thing. And so when we look back on that period of history when people, and let's be clear, the so-called robber barons were taking real things and creating real wealth with them. You know, this was Standard Oil figuring out how to manufacture and distribute oil and petroleum products, which was a vast boon to our society. These were railroad magnates and the like. So, but we look back at that time and say, that wasn't so good, having that concentration of power in such a few people's hands. And so we wanted to go a different way. The exact same condition exists today, except that the people and institutions and corporations that are the primary holders of the majority of the world's identifiable wealth today, in extraordinarily concentrated fashion, none of them actually make anything. 17 of the top 50 companies are banks. They're banks, you know. And when we look at this dynamic right now, we see a company like Blackstone going out and buying up thousands and thousands of properties in areas, you know, like Atlanta and Miami and places like that. And if you really chase that dynamic down, you find out, okay, so you have the Federal Reserve creating money out of thin air, driving interest rates really low, creating a really low cost of capital for a big company like Blackstone, who then borrows money at these extraordinarily favorable rates and then buys these properties. If you followed that trail along, what happened was money got printed out of thin air, went through this distributor network, as you called it, and ended up buying real things that you and I, real people, need to work very hard to try and, you know, live in and own and accumulate and finally pay off, hopefully. And so that dynamic has run so long so far that there are 147 super companies in the world that basically control about 40% of the entire identifiable net worth of the whole network of corporations out there. So it's a pretty big chunk. And that's just 147 companies. And of those, you look at the top 50, and 17 of those top 50 are banks. And quite a number of those, the rest of them are insurance companies, financial services, and brokerage houses, places like that. But fundamentally, they're just moving paper from point A to point B. That's their job. And that's where all of the wealth is concentrated right now, more concentrated than it was at the height of the robber baron era, and with the difference being that this time it's concentrated in the hands of people who fundamentally, and I hope I don't make too many of them mad by saying this, but they don't create value. They harvest value. They move paper from point A to point B. You know, when you think about J.P. Morgan earning $24 billion in a year, you have to ask, well, what did they make? What did they do? $24 billion, that's a huge amount of profits. That's 30% more than GE is going to make. And they make a lot of identifiable things, millions of things. So what did J.P. Morgan do? And you can't point to a single bridge that they built or a single house that got constructed or a single grain of food that got, you know, onto a table because of what they did. They moved paper from point A to point B. That's the world we live in. And we can, you know, moralize about it, but it's really, I see that level of concentration is an extraordinary risk to our stability, social stability, or potentially worldwide or intercontinental stability. It needs to be talked about. And unfortunately, it's really not being addressed anywhere within the political sphere right now in the U.S. It's certainly not being discussed in any of the newspapers, but if you understand who owns them and how many of those are held by those top 50 companies, it all makes sense. But we're really not having the dialogue we need to have around that, and that's the part where I'm glad that at least you and I have the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, and I would guess the last 13 years have allowed for a greater consolidation and concentration of that productive ownership and control. We had the end of Glass-Steagall, and then we had the Commodity Futures Trading Act there in 2003, and it really set in motion. It was almost like going back to the wild, wild west and saying, you know, the rule of law that's been adopted, the sort of change in behavior that we've had since the wild west, which has tamed things down a bit, throw it all out. We're back to the wild west, and guess who's in charge? It's the banks. There's the things that held them in check, actually the restraints that were put on them in the 1930s as a result of what we saw in the 1920s. And by the way, in the 1920s, what did we have? We had that massive concentration of wealth that you were describing. Isn't that interesting? You mentioned Plutarch, an imbalance between rich and poor is the oldest and most fatal ailment of all republics. That's what was being addressed in 1933, 1932, with the implementation of Glass-Steagall. Now it's repealed, and lo and behold, we have more creativity, in quotes, in the banking community and in the financial community than we've ever seen before. It's very interesting that we're even considering Larry Summers as a potential for position of head of the Fed after his role with Robert Rubin. I mean, here's a guy who set Wall Street loose to do the things that it's doing creatively and ultimately destructively. He was one of the fathers, you know, working right alongside Rubin to make this happen. Isn't it ironic that we actually want to give him the keys to the kingdom?
Well, if I have to tell you, I've been following Mr. Summers' career for quite a while, and I think that he's been fireable in every single situation he's ever been in for
right.
malfeasance and just incompetence. And yet here he is. And so here's how one way I do admire him. He is nothing if not a political animal. And so the idea that this administration would be considering him in the chairmanship slot for the Federal Reserve tells me that they're looking for a political beast to go in there, because they're looking for an even tighter association, if that's possible, between the Fed and the government. And Larry Summers would be the perfect choice for that. He would absolutely make sure that he was defending the interests of Wall Street and the current administration, whoever that happened to be. He would be very good in that role. Would he be a good steward of the nation's wealth and finances? if past is any prediction of the future, the answer to that is a big no, capital letters, both sides. So it's just, but it's astonishing to me that he is even being considered at this point in time, because of everything we've just talked about. It's as if there is zero accountability. In fact, there's the opposite of that. The more you make a mess of things, the more the system seems to trust you at the top. And I'm not sure what's going on there, but it's absolutely the opposite of how my own personal life and my business runs. So it's a very strange thing to me.
Well, as we wrap up, there's a couple things I'd love to get your comments on. I know you've been bullish on the metals for some time, and particularly like silver, and that would imply to me that you do see sort of the continuation of the theme from the Fed and the world central bankers, that default's probably not the way we get out of this debt problem, unless you're talking about subtle default through inflation and financial repression. Maybe you could just briefly highlight your views on the metals, where they're at, where they're going from your vantage point, and then segue over to another commodity, one that you've written extensively on, and try to address this. And I'm just throwing this out perhaps as sort of a devil's advocate. Many have assumed that the dollar, I mean, I've heard this argument a couple times now, again, on Bloomberg. The dollar is going to be very strong in light of the energy revolution, which is afoot. And this is not my position, but I think it's worth discussing again, because you hold strong views on both the currency and peak oil running counter to this idea. But somehow we're going to have a revolution in strength within the dollar because of this energy revolution in the United States, bringing us towards energy independence, becoming a net exporter, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So again, sort of as we finish on a commodities note, maybe your brief overview, gold, silver, and then addressing a strong dollar as a result of this quote unquote revolution in energy.
Well, let's start with gold and silver. It's not one word to me. It's two separate words. Silver, I love silver, and I always have, and I probably always will. It's a long-term investment for me. I've ridden through a number of gut-churning moments in my career investing in silver, accumulating silver, because that's all I ever seem to do. And I love it because it's really, when you look at where it comes from and where it goes to, it's consumed industrially, it's irreplaceable in a number of functions and features within assuming I live to be, you know, ripe old age, but within the next 20 to 30 years, all identifiable known stocks of silver are going to be depleted. And the desire for it will not be depleted. It is not a substitutable element in a variety of critical industrial processes, and we're discovering more and more of those every single day. So silver is my bullish call on this idea that we are going to have a robust industrial economy in the future after we get through some rough spots, is my personal view. Gold is a different substance. It is a monetary metal. It has a monetary role, has very low other roles in my world. And I'm holding gold still, and it would be very difficult for me to part with it at this point in time, because everything that I track and care about in terms of monetary policy and fiscal policy all suggest that there's a really strong reason to hold gold from a fundamental standpoint, including negative real interest rates, high levels of deficit expenditure, other things that have correlated well with nice gold prices in the past. But more importantly, I think that the risk of an actual monetary accident on the world stage is growing larger. It's not being lessened. And it won't take much for that to get set off. You know, you mentioned it before. There has to be some agreement between all the major central banks, at least in the OECD countries, to do what they're doing. And we have that agreement for now. Will we have that agreement forever? I'm not comfortable saying yes. So gold is me saying no. I think there's chances to see how that network could break down, how it could get frayed, how one party or other could decide enough and bolt with this and turn towards what I'll call monetary sanity. So for that basis, I'm holding gold, because when that happens, not if, but it's a when that next financial accident comes along, we're going to discover that we've lost something that it was irreplaceable and we have less of it to work with, and that's trust. People are going to trust the system even less next time. And, you know, we saw post Lehman 2008, interbank credit markets just froze. Nobody trusted anybody. You know, even among the den of thieves, the thieves all, you know, did what they did best and trusted only themselves for a little while there. And that was, Lehman was a pretty big moment in time, but I think there could be bigger ones coming. So gold is just my insurance policy. I don't see any reason not to have my insurance policy. It's kind of like if I had a house up in the ridgeline in Colorado, hadn't rained in 3 years, and I just saw tinder and brush piling up around me. The chance of a fire coming through is very low, but, you know, still I'd want to be prepared for that if it came to pass. So the dollar, and especially related to the commodities piece, so here's the interesting thing. It is absolutely a great thing. You know, if the United States produces 1 million barrels more per day this year than last year, which is close to right, that's 1 million barrels a day we don't have to import, which, okay, $100 a barrel, that's $100 million a day that we no longer have to import. Now, a lot of people would look at that, and you can draw one simple conclusion, which is to say, oh, because the United States is going to have falling import costs, then this will actually be supportive of the dollar, because we're exporting fewer dollars. We are running a lower trade deficit, a lower current account deficit. That's all good reasons for a currency to go up. That's true. The downside on this, which is kind of interesting, is the idea that more and more and more countries no longer need the dollar in order to trade for what they want, which in particular, it's not true that the dollar is not backed by anything. It is. It's backed by oil. The petrodollar was set up by Kissinger, a brilliant concept, and it worked just fabulously. It meant that we could export lots and lots and lots of dollars because people needed them. Countries needed them. If you wanted to buy oil, you needed dollars. Who doesn't need oil? Well, nobody. Everybody needs it. So that was a real support mechanism for the dollar for a long time. But as the United States produces more, we're going to walk away from needing oil on the world market. And so there's less pressure from the United States for what is available out there. And secondarily, you're going to find that more and more countries are finding ways to trade for and get that oil, not using dollars at all, with China being a very active behind-the-scenes participant in standing up bilateral currency trade pairs and trying to figure out other mechanisms for accumulating the oil that it wants in a non-dollar way. So that whole field is shifting and changing, and I'm not comfortable enough to say it's as simple as noting that the United States imports less oil, therefore exports fewer dollars, therefore the dollar gets stronger. That's just one of several dynamics at play here, and it remains to be seen which will be the stronger one.
Well, great answer. I think you're right. The bilateral trade agreements are very significant in terms of replumbing the world's monetary liquidity system. And as we see more and more countries circumvent the dollar, whether that's for purchase of oil or just selling and buying gizmos and gadgets, we become less relevant. That's less pockets to be filled with dollars, and it's a significant thing when you lose an audience. Well, we want to thank you for joining us on the commentary again. Love to have you on as a guest, and it's been too long. Thank you for joining us again, and look forward to having you back.
Well, thanks. It's been a real pleasure, and I look forward to that, too.
David, it's unfortunate, but Detroit truly is a metaphor. I mean, what Chris was saying about running it until it breaks, and then finally admitting it after it's broken, you know, it's too late by then.
The stakes are too high to admit too early. And that's really what we see, is that everyone is in sort of an all-out fight to maintain the status quo. Even if they have doubts about the methods being employed, the stakes are simply too high to do anything else except continue on. As Chris points out, this sort of run-out function, it's fascinating. Detroit is a metaphor for what we have on a grander scale across the country. Unsustainable debts, GDP that isn't supporting the growth in debt that we still have. And yes, the idea that somehow we will someday look back and say, well, we were broke a long time ago. We just couldn't fess up to it until it was just so painfully obvious that it was something akin to a social revolution. Might we have that? It, just an awareness. Social revolution in terms of an awareness that this system is truly broken.
Well, you've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney and our guest today, Dr. Chris Martinson. You can find us at McIlvaney.com. That's McIlvaney.com. Or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.